Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is J. Ryan Straddle, author of The Logger Queen of Minnesota, published by Pamela Dorman Books just in July. Jay is the author of Kitchens of the Great Midwest, which won numerous awards. He has written for The Wall Street Journal, Vanity Fair, McSweeney's, one of my favorite publications, amongst many others. So The Logger Queen of Minnesota is a novel about beer. I guess to a certain extent, beer is one of the protagonists of this story. But the heroine of the book is Edith Magnuson, a mistress of pies, a hard worker, and a good person. But because, you know, bad things do come to good people, she becomes widowed, underemployed, saddled, at first, with taking care of her teenaged granddaughter, Beverly. Edith's sister is, for most of the novel, the polar opposite of Edith. They're estranged because of an act that Helen chooses and Edith chooses to respond to. But once again, and in closing this introduction, we learn a lot about beer, the good and bad of it, the making of it, and how it can forge friendships, enmity, and sometimes love. So welcome, Jay, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I guess because of my introduction, why beer? How did you decide?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest, in Minnesota, which has a very robust history in brewing. Of course, when I was born, there were only 120 breweries in the entire country, about five or six of which happened to be in Minnesota at the time. Now there are over 120 in Minnesota alone. And I really wanted to talk about that history and have that beer history be a part of a story, be part of a family story. And in doing so, in the process of writing this book, I visited over 40 breweries in the country, mostly in the Midwest, and interviewed brewers and owners of breweries, including the owner of Shell's, which is the second oldest continuously family-run brewery in the country after Yuengling, and got insight on that operation, on large-scale lager operation, as well as contemporary craft brew operation, and the book handles both. And similar to Pennsylvania, Minnesota has a really great history of both. You know, a lot of German and Czech settlement. In the 1880s, there were four breweries in my hometown at one point or another. and I come from a pretty small town. And, yeah, I really wanted to talk about that and explore this beverage that is a unique part of American history and has evolved more in the last 15 years than I'd say just about any other realm of food or beverage.
And it's...
So I thought there was a lot there, and a lot there that was specifically Midwest, too.
And it's funny, because I remember, because Yuengling was just around here in Pottsville, which is not too far away, and it was just a local brewery, but then they won that lawsuit against Stroh's, and all of a sudden, when I was living in Florida, there's Yuengling everywhere, and it is everywhere. And even around here, if you just say you want a lager, that's what you get.
Yeah.
Or downtown, you might get PBR, and it's just the way it works. And Dogfish Head, which is in the book, 90-minute ale, is my girlfriend's favorite beer, and it's right around the corner from where we're broadcasting right now. So, I know. And so a lot of this really was great for me, because, and my brother brews beer, and he has four taps in his bar in the basement, so the first thing I did when I read the book was give him a copy, because he's going to love it.
Oh, that's so kind.
I know. Well, it's a good thing to give to him. But, you know, actually, the other thing is, going back a bit to Kitchens of the Great Midwest, Edith's pies also play a big part in the story. And,
that's right.
And actually, they kind of lead her around for a while. I mean, if you talk a little bit about this, she's doing this for 37 years of making them, and she's doing it in the same kind of place where my mom spent her last year. And it's fascinating, because when she was there, everybody in her little cafeteria. It was nicer than mm-hmm. a cafeteria, but everybody there wanted their dessert, and they would tap their glasses, and the 105-year-old lady would just raise her hand, and I was amazed that she could raise her hand for so long.
Mm.
And she would just
the power move, yeah.
And they would always come out with the pie, and the pies were good. Everything was the desserts were kind of good. But why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, how she won, how the nursing home won the prize that it did and that thing, because it's really interesting.
Oh, thank you. Well, that aspect of Edith is directly based on my grandmother's experience. She was a dietary aide at a nursing home in Minnesota for over 25 years. And I visited her many times there. Visiting my grandparents meant going to that nursing home, because we'd not only visit my grandmother at work, but my grandmother would take us there on her off hours to visit the residents who didn't have usual visitors. And we would bring them gifts and hang out with them and watch Jeopardy. And my grandmother would talk about the food that she helped prepare, serve, and contrast it with the food we had at home. And I always thought, oh boy, you know, can't you ever just bring a pie? And she said, well, I can't bake enough for everybody at home. And she didn't really want to play favorites, you know. So in essence, what Edith is sort of a realization of a dream of my grandmother's to be able to do this, to be able to bring her homemade desserts, you know, to work and for the benefit of a great number of people. And much like Edith, my grandmother Doris would have absolutely been uninterested in any sort of attention this would draw. Yeah, she'd be doing it to do it. She would eschew any headline or photo opportunity, much as Edith does, and actually be, you know, much like Edith was, a little disgusted by it. You know, so I think it's kind of a long dream of mine to write about my grandmother's experience working in this nursing home. And, you know, they were such a big part of my life and such a big part of American lives. I mean, I come from a large family of truck drivers, nurses, and farmers, and certainly a family where a number of farms have been sold to pay for nursing homes for the former farmers. So, yeah, it was something I felt very passionate about writing about, and also writing about in a kind of a hopeful, upbeat, even optimistic way.
Yeah, it was. It's funny because with my mom, we used to watch Wheel of Fortune. And,
oh, yeah.
And the thing about it was she was kind of going deaf, and I always yelled at her. She yelled back. It's the way we lived for 67 years. And so when we watched Wheel of Fortune, she would go, I can't hear, so I can't get this. I said, Mom, it's just letters, and they pick them, so you don't need to hear. And we get into fights over that. But
Right. Yeah, it's much like Jeopardy. Well, I guess no. I mean,
not,
you have to hear the reply.
Yeah.
They don't. Yeah. More than Jeopardy, you can perfectly understand Wheel of Fortune with the sound off.
But she used it as her excuse because I was better. I was way better than she was. But anyway, so my next question you already kind of answered, which is, why is Edith so? It's a little bit different. Why is she so accepting of everything that comes her way without being either enthusiastic or dismayed? Is that like your grandma or? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people on both sides of my family, actually, in Minnesota, are just very stoic.
Yeah.
Like they didn't dwell on times of vulnerability or loss, and they didn't celebrate times of fortune. You know, they felt everything is provisional. And maybe that came from being, you know, both sides were farm families, and maybe that came out of that, like just not knowing what's around the bend. You know, year, like day to day, month to month, year to year. There's always something new, and you just have to deal with it. You know, a cow that was healthy last week is sick today. You know, a hailstorm goes through, you know, destroys part of a roof, you know, knocks out car windows, you know, that kind of stuff. Blizzard snows you in for 3 days. What do you do?
Right.
Yeah, you never know what's around the corner.
Yeah, and one year your crops don't come in, or you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, or you know, you get not enough rain. You get too much rain.
Yeah.
It seemed like a very difficult life for them, for my grandparents and their cousins, in a lot of ways, in terms of just being able to withstand these extremes of fortune and dismay. But what it created in their constitution was just a really steely tolerance of of human nature and circumstance that saw them through a lot of difficult personal issues. So yeah, I wanted to put that in my characters.
So yeah, so like, I'm not saying it's autobiographical, but you drew on a lot of things involving your family. So the next question I wanted to ask was, and I don't want to do any spoilers and I don't want to give anything away, so just answer as much as you want to. It's like Helen and Edith, when they were children, and when you're talking about pies and the state fair, there's something that it seemed like it shaped Helen to a certain extent and involves what her mother told her to do. Do you think it did? I mean, I think it did.
Yeah, I think it did, too. Yeah, I felt like, you know, Helen was the sort of person that, unlike Edith, wanted a certain amount of recognition for what she was good at. She identified things that she liked, and she wanted, you know, at least for a while,
yeah,
you know, wanted to be prominent in a way that Edith didn't. Now, into adulthood, without giving too much away, Helen kind of backs away from that. There's a point later in the book where she looks back at her career and goes, well, maybe I should have been in the public eye a little bit more. You know, but I remember writing her preteen and teenage scenes, thinking, now this is a woman that really wants more for herself than what the world around her is providing. And I identified with that. I thought the same way as a teenager growing up in a small town in Minnesota. Now, Helen was more willing to leave the past behind than I was. I didn't want to exclude my upbringing from my future. I wanted to carry it with me. I wanted to add to my life experience. I didn't feel a need to subtract anything to progress. And Helen sort of does. Without giving too much away, that's kind of what she's about.
Well,
and I knew that kind of people too, the sort of people that felt like, you know, my current situation where I live isn't doing me a lot of good. I'm willing to burn it down to move forward, and I'm willing to confuse destruction for progress.
Yeah, and later on when Helen begins her career, you know, she doesn't really get the credit because women didn't get the credit.
And, that's right.
Yeah, and her husband and other people, that other guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I felt like I needed to illustrate that for historical accuracy. It's not just a perspective of Helen from what I read and from what I was told from interviewing people. That's kind of what the landscape was, unfortunately.
And
so she, you know, being Helen, is always looking for an angle. You know, she's an ambitious person, and she's going to, like her sister, like her parents, going to make the best out of whatever situation she's in.
And the way she approaches beer and the beginning of her career, it's not that she, none of it has to do with intoxication. That was fascinating to me, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
This is just something that intrigues her. I mean, she admits a little bit that it helps that it's kind of a a cult object in her family's eyes, that she has family members, including a grandfather that is a complete teetotaler. And so there's a bit of mystique around this substance, you know, and that's alluring. Like, she admits to that.
I like when she's...
But that said, she was prepared to be disappointed. You know, her grandfather said she'd go to hell if she had one drop of beer. So she just takes a very little sip at the beginning, hoping that much would be forgiven because she believes in hell. And it turns out she loves it. You know, just one of these things that sometimes, you know, teenagers encounter, you know, whether if it's a musical instrument, an artistic inclination, a form of engineering, or creation, that they just have a knack for.
Yeah.
And, yeah, this experience, first time drinking beer at age 15, ignites something in her that makes her feel like this is not just an intoxicant. This is something curious that I want to unpack.
I guess it's like when you see some little girl who has decided she's going to play the tuba. And I always wonder, you know, or when doctors become proctologists, you know, it's like...
But it's
funny because, as we discussed a little bit before the show, and we were talking about why some beers... Well, my brother is a real beer snob and goes, you know, you're not worthy of my beers. He actually uses those words. And when she buys the car... And the guy says, "Do you want a beer?" And he opens his refrigerator, and he's got Coors and Corona and Stroh's. And she and she decides he's a complete. I'm not even going to use the word, but. And that's how my brother is. You know, it's like drinking
water.
I thought
that was pretty funny on Diana's part, that she's come that far, or that she went through that phase en route, where she's becoming more confident in her opinions, but, you know, she's still not fully evolved.
You know, it's interesting.
I think there's a phase, you know, a phase of that. I don't think it's necessarily a destination or an end game that people arrive at. I think, you know, people who are more confident and secure are usually more tolerant. But that said, you know, they have boundaries for themselves. You know, they'll say, you know, "Hey, I won't drink Miller Lite, but you can go knock yourself out." Yeah, and it was funny to realize that I'm at this point with her in her knowledge of beer that she would feel this way. And she's getting to that point where she's judging people. I mean, I remember being a person around her age and being, you know, someone born in 1975. I was a young person in the 90s and going to people's homes and judging them by the CD collection. You know, what kind of music are you into? I'm like, "Oh boy, this isn't going to work," you know.
Yeah, I've done that. I've done that many
times. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I've thankfully grown past that.
Well, you know, that reminds me of, I wanted to ask you this because, you know, the name of the beer is Blatz. And,
yeah.
And in Philadelphia, there was this beer called Blatz.
Right, out of Wisconsin.
Yeah, and it was bought by, who was it bought by? It was bought by Pabst, I think. I think it was.
Yeah, I think PBR, yeah.
Yeah, and it was horrible. And it was cheap. So that's what what we drank. But, yeah.
It filled a market niche. There was a lot of lager like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I mentioned Blatz in the book so as to not
confuse
it with Blatz.
Yeah.
You know, Blatz was meant to be a contemporary of Blatz. And Stroh's and Schaefer and a lot of other discontinued lagers or lagers that are, you know, whose labels might continue, but whose, you know...
Right, that's basically all
brewery operations do not.
Yeah, basically it's just a label. And I think their motto might have been the best beer in Minneapolis. Maybe, I think it was.
Yeah, it might have been. Yeah, that's a contentious claim.
Yeah.
Even then, I mean, in the era of Greenbelt and Schmidt and Hams, yeah.
Yeah,
got some contenders for that crown.
Yeah,
my
father got one of those beer signs that you light up on the wall. It had a little pull chain, and he got it for Schmitz, and he got another one. And he got another one for Schlitz too, which are all.
Oh
gone.
My God! Wow.
So that was next to our pool table in the basement. So it was like a little bar.
Perfect.
Yeah, I know.
Perfect.
So back to your book, so we can sell your book.
No problem.
So your book walks back and forth between the 50s and kind of like the present. And sometimes that creates some difficulty for the reader. But I found it like really seamless and appropriate, and you didn't get mixed up. And that's did you feel that way when you wrote it? Did it kind of like seamlessly you said to yourself, "All right, now I have to go back."
Right. Yeah, no, I felt I needed to tell stories that were sequential, if not, you know, these stories weren't contemporaneous, but I needed them to be both sequential and consequential of each other. So So each story begins at its beginning. You know, each character only progresses forward from the point you meet them. But I wanted to illustrate different aspects of the family relationship, which meant that some character you're going to meet, you know, 50 years before you meet the other one. And by giving myself that latitude, I was able to tell what I felt was a more complete story. And I did put the character's name in the year that the chapter begins, at the beginning of each chapter, to help guide the reader and orient them. Because, well, it's fun to do some work as a reader. I like books that I call work as a reader. It's not fun to be disoriented. There's a difference between, you know, writing a book that respects the reader's intelligence and confusing them. And I didn't want to confuse them. But that said, when putting this book together, I felt, oh, this will be also a fun way to incorporate, you know, the last 50 or 60 years of Midwest brewing history.
Yeah, you anticipate a lot of my questions. So did you? The book seems as if everybody's a good person. But
there's really only one nasty person.
But
the guy at the impound lot.
I forgot about him. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But he gets his comeuppance, like my dad used say, what goes around comes around. And it's definitely true. But Beverly has some issues early on. A lot of it because
or Diana.
Diana, I'm sorry. Diana.
Yeah.
Yeah, has some issues early on.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make it her a bad person, and part of it's because of her friend. But that's what turns the whole book around. I mean, it's pivotal.
I agree. When you meet her, I don't cast her in the most flattering light. You know,
not at all.
Not in a good place.
Yeah, and she does is so easy, too. I never really thought about how easy that would be.
I know, especially in the Midwest. I mean, this kind of thing would happen. And I remember growing up, and my dad, you know, going out to the garage in the morning in the summer and realizing, oh, I didn't lock the side door to the garage again, you know. Nothing happened. But there were many days I remember him realizing that. Like, he'd come in, like, after putting in the mower the night before and had forgotten to lock the door behind him. And, you know, or people who accidentally left their garage door open overnight.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and you're in Minnesota, so there's a lot of power tools.
There's a lot of power tools. Yes, all season power tools. And one thing I also tried to illustrate was that there's a culture of just hanging out in the garage.
Oh, yeah.
All up and down my street in the summer, people would open their garage door, set a couple of folding chairs, lawn chairs, in their garage facing out towards the street, and sit there with a cooler beer, sometimes a radio between them, and just hang up there and watch the world go by. You know, just sit there, drink beer in the garage, looking out at the street, saying hi to neighbors as they came home from work, and kids biking up and down the street. And
we'd wait for
that was a very common thing.
Yeah, we would wait for the ice
culture and people creating, you know, what's the word? Bespoke furniture for the garage or furnishings. And garages were, you know, not just a storage space in the summer. They were kind of a den.
Yeah, we used to sit there and wait for the ice cream truck to come down the alleyway. And I'm way older than you. We also had the gypsy wagon that came up, and they would sharpen knives. And then my father would use that same card table that you're talking about and play cribbage with his best friend for hours.
Oh, my God, perfect cribbage.
Do you play cribbage? Did you ever?
Sure.
Really? Yeah, my father loved it. My brother learned how to play it really well, but I was always upset because I couldn't. It's like Helen and Edith. I couldn't do it as well, so I kind of gave it up. But, you know, so going back to the idea of people being good and talking about Diana and the car lot guy. So Helen, I was going to say, is really the only, and again, without giving anything away, and it's hard to do it in your book because there's a lot of spoilers, but she's like the only villain, but then she also is not one-dimensional. She's three-dimensional. And it turns out, so is Edith, too. And I think that, And that's the other thing, too, that you talked about a little bit, about readers working. So when you finish the book and it goes out into the world and you're, well, this is your second born child, do you feel like, okay, it's gone now, they need to understand it, or does the reader need to work to get, okay, I understand now why this happened? So you like that. You like when the reader has to think.
Yes.
Yeah.
I employed something similar with my first book in terms of the narrative gaps I left open for the reader to conclude for her or himself what happened in this elapsed time.
Yeah, that's what I always
say. Yeah, I like that as a reader. I like filling in gaps.
Yeah, I love at the end of a book, too.
Yeah, and there's a lot of very subtle connection in this book to characters, minor characters that appear in one part of the book, suddenly reappear or have offspring reappear in later chapters, and an attentive reader will pick up on that.
Yeah,
it's just something I like to put little things there.
Yeah, it's like Edith's co-worker at. I don't know what that was. Yeah, it's like Edith's co-worker at Arby's. Was it Arby's?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there she is, and then there she is.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's hard not to give anything away. again, each of them goes through kind of a sea change. You know, they become a different person than what they are. Each of them changes to a certain extent, especially in the last line of the book where you get... You know, you get this insight, and and a lot of it's about love, and that's what I said in the introduction. You know, a lot of it's about love.
Yeah, I wanted more books like that in the world.
Yeah,
already a lot of dystopias. I don't think I'd be very good at writing one.
Yeah, or a book that has the word "girl" in the title. I think I own an independent bookstore, so I think I've counted like 42 books that have the word "girl" in the title. Yeah. So I have a mental picture, and also the book is cinematic, and hopefully that'll mean something to you in the near future. But
I hope so too.
Yeah,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but you know, it's very cinematic. So I have this mental picture of Edith and Helen, but I don't know if I'm right. I know that Edith is tall, and I know that
she played basketball.
Yeah, and I think that Helen is more attractive, but I'm not quite sure. Well, I guess I am kind of sure. Mm-hmm. Do you have an image of each in your mind?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, not really based around a specific person. So I can't say that, Helen's Meryl Streep and Edith is June Squibb or something like that. I just pulled those names out of a hat, by the way. I feel like, in that my image of them also evolved in over time. Yeah, but yeah, no, I don't cast the book. I mean, maybe some writers do, it's fine. But I think about them I think about my characters in terms of their character or their souls more than their physical being. One of the things people have remarked to me, and this is something that I don't really consciously do, is that, there's not a lot of physical descriptions of your characters. I guess I only consciously eschew that in the sense that quite often when I'm introducing a character, it's in the context of another character's close third representation of them. And being that point of view character is often intimately familiar with this person they're discussing, there wouldn't be a description of of their body because, you know, it's not relevant to the scene unless there's something surprising about the way they're presenting themselves physically.
Yeah, and
I feel like in order to keep a naturalistic tone throughout the book, a character's physical appearance is usually only described by someone meeting them for the first time. And even then, not terribly often. I find the physical descriptions to be a little tedious and homogenous.
Yeah.
But that said, I felt if there's a physical attribute that's relevant to the story, like Edith's height, for example, Helen's charisma, you know, something that will pay off, something that will have ramifications then I'll bring it up.
Yeah, the one character I had a perfect composite mental image of, only because I spent that last year of my mother's life visiting her every single day, as did my two brothers. And it was in this place called Wellington Terrace. And so at lunch, there was always this traffic jam between wheelchairs and rollerladers and walkers. And, you know, I was always afraid there'd be some kind of major pileup. And but so Shoddy Vecchio, I have him in my mind perfectly. I know exactly what he looked like. But I don't know if that's right. It's just that, and that's another good thing for the reader, is to be able to draw back on his or her experience and say, oh, yeah, I know who he is. Because I knew so many people that treated their caretakers, and sometimes my mom, who would wheel people around in that particular way, which was not really nice, but at the same time, really humorous. And part of it was complimentary, even though it didn't sound it at the time. And so, I had a really good idea of who he was. He was a good character. That's the other thing you did that was I thought was really well done, is there's characters, again, like the parking lot guy, that only appear in a couple of paragraphs, but they're drawn really well.
Oh, thanks.
I mean...
Yeah, I try to do my best with that. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think, unless you correct me, it seems like you have, to a certain extent, met some of these people. I know I have in car lots when my car was towed.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I've met people like that. Various desks over my 40-plus years, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I go there thinking I have enough.
Well, I also have an image of him, you know. Yeah. And,
yeah.
Yeah, I remember coming across people like him visiting my grandmother's nursing home as well.
And they usually had baseball shirts on, or World's Greatest Dad, or a hat that said something on it. And they were kind of mean, but, you know, you could always... many times get through to them, and then you'd see the sense of humor. And that's how I feel about this guy, actually.
Yeah.
You kind of...
And another thing about that I remember about visiting nursing homes, that without, you know, this is a very mild spoiler, is like how Shoddy Vecchio was trying to give stuff away. Like, I would always encounter that as a child when I would visit, you know, Mary Tedder, Alice Sell, or the other Mildred Freeman, the other women that my grandmother had befriended, who were residents at the nursing home. They were always giving things to me. And not just money or candy, but personal possessions. And I thought, well, this is interesting. You know, as an eight-year-old, I was delighted and surprised. But sometimes they were a little unwieldy, or they were something that wasn't, you know, not cohesive with the dreams of what a child would consider to be a gift. You know, something like a lockbox or a camera. You know, like a SLR camera, you know.
Yeah.
So, I thought about that a lot when writing characters like Shoddy.
When you get older, as I am, you do want to start giving things away, because you're all the material stuff you have kind of drags you down. There's this good book called Death Cleaning, and it's not really about cleaning when you're about to die. It's just like, okay, what are my kids going to want? Are they going to want this?
Yeah.
It's my responsibility, and it's being nice to them to get rid of this stuff. And when my mother passed on, we still haven't done it, but you go to her house, and she wasn't really a hoarder, but we didn't know. We had no idea of what she had saved. And when you go down to the basement, it's just amazing, and we're like so overwhelmed, we don't know what to do. Do we give it all away? Do we sell it? Do we get one of those estate people in? What do we do? And we've been thinking about it for 6 months now.
Yeah.
We, you know, she's still getting mail. We haven't even stopped the mail.
Oh, man.
She still gets time and people. It's pretty funny. But anyway, yeah, so the idea of her working so long and working so hard all the time, and when a scene comes again, not spoiling it at all, when a scene comes again, when Helen does something and someone responds, well, why didn't you, do you know what we've been through, do you understand? That's also a very poignant scene, and also it's a nice pivotal scene too as well when she comes to her door. Okay, so again, And this will be our last question, and then you can move on with all the things you have to do today, including many other interviews, I imagine. So does this book end the way that you planned at the beginning, or did it surprise you?
It has the exact tone I intended before I wrote the first word.
It's amazing. I can't even...
Yeah, when I sit down to write a novel, I have an idea of an ending, like the tone of the ending. I know what... For lack of a better term, I kind of know what message I want to send, ultimately. Then I try to start really far away from there.
Yeah, that's how you have to... Yeah, that's the whole book, is how you get to that point.
Yeah, exactly, and how it feels earned and inevitable, but maybe surprising at the same time. Like, oh, I didn't see this happening.
Yeah.
I didn't see it happening this way.
Yeah, it must be a great...
But the same was true of my first book. Like, I knew what the last scene was going to be before I started writing, and I... try to create a situation to make that ending feel like a hopelessly remote possibility.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
With that, let's close it out. And I really appreciate. Oh, you know, and I wanted to tell you, since I own Wellington Square Books, the front table has a stack of your books on it. The first one was purchased by me for my brother, and I expect it to do really well. And if you're ever in our area, which is in Chester County, Pennsylvania, we'd love to have you come by.
Oh, I'd love to come by. Thank you.
Okay. Pleasure talking to you today, Jay.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you as well. Thanks for the excellent question.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We were talking with Jay Ryan Straddle, whose second book, The Lager Queen of Minnesota, is an excellent book about people, how they can change, how a relationship can evolve into another relationship. And again, without giving anything away, how the beginning leads to this ending that is very, very satisfying. And sometimes, these people I interview, sometimes the ending is also satisfying, but only because you have to think, hey, is what I think the way the author really meant this to be? And in this book, it's kind of like you're rooting for certain people and you're rewarded at the end. So anyway, it was a pleasure talking to him, and we have some good people lined up. Amy Waldman is going to discuss her highly anticipated book, which is called A Door in the Earth, about Afghanistan, and changes our view completely about America's involvement in this longest war we've had, and that the things sometimes that we do there that we think are really good might not be what we thought they were. So, yeah, it's a really good book. And then the National Book Award winner and Pulitzer Prize finalist Tim O'Brien, who wrote The Things They Carried, which was an incredible book, is going to join us to discuss his memoir, Dad's Maybe Book, which is a complete departure, but just as good. So those are what's coming up. If you want to check some other things that are coming up or that we just did, just go to our website or go to Podomatic, or go to WCHE's website, or in a couple of days after, because usually when I post it to Podomatic, it takes 1 or 2 days, then it goes to iTunes, where you can listen to it on iTunes, or if you have the iTunes app podcasts and you subscribe, then you'll have all the interviews that I've done over the past 6 or 7 years, all 400 hours of me talking. And if you do it twice speed, which you can still understand, then you only have to listen to me talking half the time. So in any event, thanks as always for joining us today, and we look forward to having you back here next week on The Avid Reader.